Hello, I'm Bart King. This is episode number 0389 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0389. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, a return visit from NASA expert Rod Pyle, who's back on the show to talk about the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 1 fire.
Gene Kranz really put it beautifully in remarks he made the following Monday to his control team after the fire. They had reassembled, obviously, a very somber room. And to paraphrase, he just said, look, we were moving too fast. We weren't looking at the obvious signs of danger that were staring us in the face, and that will never happen again. And he kind of push the reset button along with upper management on the whole process.
Mickey Trowbridge offers up a unique yoga experience called beer yoga. It takes place at a brewery.
We started our first class in the summer of 2013 and thought we'd have maybe 20 friends come out for yoga and then a beer afterwards. And we had 100 people show up for that first class. It was amazing. And what we discovered there is we weren't the only people that enjoyed both yoga and beer, and that it can be this really lovely blend of coming together for a yoga practice, which tends to be focused more on yourself and giving yourself what you need, and then not just heading back off into life and into obligations after class, but staying and gathering as a community and sharing a beer.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter settles for more with soon-to-be NBC News correspondent Megan Kelly. Get ready for some hard-hitting questions coming up soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0389, was Bart King, the non-award-winning author of the Disney novel The Drake Equation. And by the way, the term non-award-winning author, those are Bart's words, not mine. No one would ever say that about Bart King except himself. To all who know him, he is award-winning in every way. Thank you very much, Bart, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And by the way, you can go to the link on the Stuff File page for this program, which you just heard Bart say, number 0389, and you'll also find the link to Bart's page and his book, even though it's not award-winning. There you go. Thanks, Bart. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 42-year-old Jernine Green and her niece, 18-year-old Tia Prado, were playing a game with other family members in Green's Stock Island, Florida home. Prado told sheriff's deputies that during the game, Green accused her of stealing money and attacked her, allegedly hitting her in the mouth with a piece of wood, stabbing her in the ear with a screwdriver, and biting two of her fingers. A family member broke up the fight, and Monroe County Sheriff's Office deputies responded. Green was arrested on suspicion of felony aggravated battery with a deadly weapon and held on $20,000 bond. She has multiple arrests and two prior convictions for battery-related charges. The game they were playing? Well, the home edition of Family Feud. Yes, we polled 100 people and asked them this question. Top answer on the board. Name a game you shouldn't play with violent relatives. Survey says, The Family Feud. Yes, I'm sorry, Jernine Green. You're a loser. Now, most mothers are leery about letting their teenage daughters have an unsupervised party with plenty of boys at their home. That's understandable. Here's a story that's not understandable. A mother was arrested after having sex with students at her daughter's party. The Florida mother is facing 7 different charges after providing alcohol to minors and having sex with 5 boys at her daughter's party. Police say that 40-year-old Jamie Ayer returned to her home to find that her daughter was throwing a party with her friends. Ayer began socializing with the teens and provided them with alcohol, police said. She then told one teenager that she needed a shower, and she invited him to, quote, come to help her, police say. Classic. She then had sex with five boys. Three of the boys are 16 and two are 17. Police began an investigation after receiving a tip after the wild party. Because, you know, teenage boys having sex with a 40-year-old woman, they're not going to be able to keep their mouth shut. Yeah. Although the sex acts were consensual, the boys are underage, and therefore Ayer was arrested on charges of unlawful sexual activity. The mother is being charged and held on $22,000 bail. You know, I'm wondering just how competitive this mother is with her daughter. Conversely, I'm wondering if the boys are now wondering how competitive the daughter is with her mother. Yeah. An 18-year-old woman sitting in her car at a 7-Eleven store in San Mateo, California, says another woman came up to her window and started arguing with her over a parking spot. She says the woman then attacked her with a knife, stabbing her in the arm and hand before fleeing. The victim was able to give police a description of the assailant and her car, including the license plate number. Police identified the attacker as 21-year-old Jessica Greenbaum, who was quickly arrested on charges of attempted homicide, assault with a deadly weapon, and criminal threats. Police say that after the stabbing, Greenbaum sped away in the vehicle that the victim described. So, if she sped away, I guess she didn't really need that parking spot after all. Huh. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a young Massachusetts man who accidentally shot himself in the chest while deer hunting on Christmas Eve, use the other end, pal, is home from the hospital. A cousin told their local newspaper that 19-year-old Hunter Richardson of Orange told him this week that he was going home from UMass Memorial Medical Center in Worcester. That cousin, Patrick Duval, who lives in Nevada, says Richardson is doing better. Now, Richardson confirmed via Facebook that he is now at home. He had been hospitalized since December 24th. State Environmental Police said Richardson's rifle discharged as he tested the thickness of ice with the butt of the muzzle loader on the morning of December 24th in Orange, Massachusetts. Major William Bellotta said local police and the man's family staunched the bleeding and helped him survive. Okay. Simple physics and science dictates that perhaps if you're checking the thickness of ice with the butt of your rifle, then it's pointed in the wrong direction. Also, maybe his parents overshot wide 19 years ago by naming their child Hunter. Either way, this could be considered a Darwin File starter kit case because this is a precursor to how people eventually learn to remove themselves from the planet at a later date. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Last week marked the 50th anniversary of a tragedy at NASA. On January 27, 1967, three astronauts, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, lost their lives on the launch pad during testing of Apollo 1. NASA expert Rod Pyle is on with us again on the show to look back at that devastating day and the impact it had on the space race. Rod is the author of Amazing Stories of the Space Age and joins us from California via Skype. Hi, Rod.
Good evening. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for being on the program. It was only a couple of weeks ago we had you on the show, and we don't usually have you back on that fast, but I felt it important to have you on only because this is also the time period of the 31st anniversary of the Challenger explosion, and I don't want to take away from that tragedy at all, but it seems to be one of the things people want to talk about more because it's more recent in our history and people remember it more. But I don't want people to forget Apollo 1, so that's why I thought I'd give you a call.
That's a great idea, and I appreciate it. And, you know, both, I mean, the real effect I think that these both had, besides our collective memories, is that they really changed the way that NASA looked at safety in spaceflight. And shortly after the Apollo 1 fire, the Soviet Union had their own disaster when their first Soyuz capsule malfunctioned and fouled up and made a hard impact on landing and killed the cosmonaut that was flying it. That was their entry into the moon race. So there's a lot of anniversaries coming up, not all of them pleasant memories.
Now, this was brought to my mind again. Again, it's always in my forefront, remembering the 50th anniversary this year, but it was reinforced by an article written in a publication that I just saw a few days ago. It's written by a woman by the name of Kaylee Rogers, who is retelling the story of her grandfather, who is Henry Rogers, who is a NASA quality control inspector and one of the, what, five or six people who tried to get that hatch open to save those three astronauts. So and in that she tells the story of what happened in her article. It's a great article, and I'll post it on the website as well. But from your perspective, and you touched on it just briefly, it was part of the bellwether of getting more safety implemented into the Apollo missions that were to eventually take off and go to the moon, right?
Yeah, and Gene Kranz really put it beautifully in remarks he made the following Monday to his control team after the fire. They had reassembled, obviously, a very somber room. And to paraphrase, he just said, look, we were moving too fast. We weren't looking at the obvious signs of danger that were staring us in the face. And that will never happen again. And he kind of pushed the reset button along with upper management on the whole process. So the logistics of the accident, just in very broad strokes, were they had the Apollo 1 spacecraft, which was an earlier version. It wasn't the same one they were planning to fly to the moon, but the command module, the capsule part, was an earlier design. But they were going to use that for the first test flights in February of 1967, put it up in Earth orbit, make sure everything's working, maybe stay up there for 2 weeks, and astronauts Grissom, White, and Chaffee would be the ones to fly it. So they were testing it on the pad 50 years ago. It was called a plugs-out test, so it was on internal power, meaning it was running off batteries, but it was not fueled. All the pyrotechnics, the explosive bolts and so forth, were turned off. So basically, it was an inert rocket there sitting and running under its own electrical power, so nobody expected there to be any danger. They had been at this since 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 6:30 that night. Everybody's getting grumpy. Gus Grissom, who was the commander, could be a little grumpy at the best of times, but he had a lot of reasons to be grumpy because they were having a lot of problems with the spacecraft. They had had over 700 items that were errors and mistakes and problems since it had been delivered to Cape Kennedy, as they called it then, that North America and NASA were trying to resolve. So this Block 1 Apollo spacecraft was really a mess. And there were frayed wires and leaky coolant and all kinds of other things. So a pure oxygen environment inside. Normally in space, that's running about 4 to 5 pounds per square inch. And at that pressure, oxygen's still risky, but it's not explosive like it is at 17 pounds per square inch, which they had pumped it up to for this test. And the capsule was filled with flammable materials, nylon, webbing, Velcro, all this stuff. So when there was a short circuit at 6:30 that evening, it just burned instantly. And, you know, fortunately for the astronauts, it only was about 15 seconds before they were asphyxiated by carbon monoxide fumes, but it was still just a horrifying scene.
And if I'm not mistaken, I believe you talk about that oxygen chamber that they were in, basically, because it was pure oxygen and because the door was set so that it could only be opened by pushing it in as opposed to pulling it out, because of the oxygen, they couldn't get the door open fast enough.
Yeah, because the pressure from the fire within seconds had pumped the inside of that tiny cabin, I think it's 300 cubic feet or something, up to, or maybe 260 cubic feet, very small, size of a medium compact car, up to about almost 30 pounds per square inch. So the capsule had three hatches, but the main one, the ceiling hatch, the one with all the strength, was inside, and it pushed into the opening like an inverse cork, if you will. So as the pressure built up, it was just pushing this hatch harder and harder into its fitting. Now, when they redesigned that in the later command modules, all the ones that came 18 months and plus afterwards, it was hinged open outward like it should have been in the first place. And there had been discussion about this. In fact, the builder of the capsule, who got a lot of the blame for the fire, North American Aviation, had said, we think it ought to be hinged and open outward like Mercury and Gemini did. But it was NASA that said, no, that's too heavy. It's unsafe. It might accidentally open or blow off while we're in space. So let's just have it fit in like a ceiling plug. And so once that fire started, there was no way those guys were going to get out. And they tried. I mean, there was evidence that they had tried to get up to the handle and release the thing. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, the techs on the pad tried to race back to the capsule once they heard the yelling and the pounding inside. But very quickly ruptured and flames and smoke came out. And they really didn't have the proper safety equipment or firefighting equipment to deal with that kind of fire. It just wasn't something anybody had ever imagined could happen. And as was said by one of the astronauts later, we had a failure of imagination. We failed to realize that something like this could happen on a routine test on the pad.
There are those who believe that Grissom, White, and Chaffee did not die in vain, that some of the changes that were made because of what had happened in their case, and that made the space race possible to be won by the Americans. Do you believe that?
I think it certainly contributed, just like the Challenger accident contributed to the improvements in safety on the shuttle. There was no way to make the shuttle a safe spacecraft that just had too many single points of failure and too many compromises in the design. Apollo was more robust. It had more redundancy. It had fewer single points of failure, although there were still a few. But that fire definitely stepped up the effort to be extremely careful, to slow down, to reassess everything. They continued development on the Saturn V and the lunar module, but the command module and the associated components of that, they put that thing in a warehouse. They took it apart down to every last nut, bolt, washer, and piece of wire, examined everything, really worked through the problem, got together with North American Aviation, the builder, and said, okay, we need to fire a few people and push the reset button. So some people that probably were not entirely to blame for this lost their jobs, as usually happens at times like this, both at NASA and at North American. But ultimately, they came up with a much better design that flew all the way until 1975 and never had a serious, other than the Apollo 13 accident, which is unrelated to the command module, never had another serious accident like this after.
And again, in reading Kaylee's excellent piece, Kaylee Rogers' excellent piece, I thought I knew a lot about Apollo 1 and most of the stuff at NASA. I was unaware of the fact that there is a plaque up on the moon to those who lost their lives.
Yeah, I think there's a plaque, and there's also a fallen astronaut statue.
Yes.
That's a very cool little aluminum statue that I think it was Armstrong placed on the surface. And every few of those flights, they'd put down something special to the program, but those two are particularly moving. And there's memorials, you know, all over the country. In fact, I was just posting the other day, if you look at a Google Maps image of Long Beach Harbor here in Los Angeles, there's four islands, man-made islands out of the harbor, that are named after Grissom, White, Chaffee, and Freeman, another astronaut who died before he was able to fly. And I didn't even know that until just a couple of years ago.
It's fascinating stuff indeed. And again, I think it's important that people not forget Apollo 1's disastrous attempt that led in the death of three of the astronauts. And also, people should check out, I give a plug to you, your book, Amazing Stories of the Space Age. Rod, I thank you once again for being on the program. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks very much. Talk to you soon.
NASA expert Rod Pyle. His latest book is Amazing Stories of the Space Age. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check for the show number for this program, which is number 0389, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. I also put in a link to that story I referred to, written by Kaylee Rogers, whose grandfather, Henry Rogers, was working as a NASA quality control inspector on that fateful day of the Apollo fire. The story was originally posted on the Motherboard page, which is one of the Vice channels online.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leak.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about beer yoga, plus Stuart Nolman's in with another edition of Book Banter. There's also an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on. And much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program I also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, in Hong Kong in December, 37-year-old Lam Chong Kan pleaded guilty to stealing a bottle of a co-worker's breast milk at work and drinking it, but only to help with stress in his job as a computer technician. Undermining the health improvement explanation was a photo Lam sent to the woman showing himself in an aroused state. Yes, well, that's a compelling explanation from a guy who clearly has deeper issues. Also, I'm guessing he fantasizes about sex only with lactating women. Anyway. Sometime in 2006, a photographer on assignment roamed a Chipotle restaurant in Denver, snapping photos of customers. Leah Caldwell was one person photographed, but says she refused to sign the photographer's release and was surprised, nonetheless, to see her photo in a Chipotle promotion in 2014 and again in 2015. And on her table in the photo were alcoholic beverages she denied ever ordering. In January, Caldwell said the misuse of her image is Chipotle's fault for ignoring her non-release, and thus she is entitled to all the profits Chipotle earned between 2006 and 2015. That would be $2.237 billion. You know, I thought she might have had a chance to win some kind of damages in this case right up until the time she stated a dollar figure. I mean, now I'm guessing she'll be shown the door, both the door of the courthouse and at Chipotle. Yeah. Okay, this next story puts a whole new perspective on the term precocious child. In December, 6-year-old Ashland Howell of Little Rock, Arkansas, deftly mashed her sleeping mother's thumbprint onto her phone to unlock the Amazon app and order $250 worth of Pokemon toys. Mom later noticed 13 email confirmations and asked Ashland if something was amiss. According to the Wall Street Journal report, Ashland said, "No, Mommy, I was shopping. Again, she's only 6. Can you imagine what her mother's future holds when the kid turns 16? Yikes. Okay, interesting developments that led to arrests. We have a couple of them here. Number one, Woodstock, Vermont police arrested a 28-year-old man for bank robbery in January. This is with a key piece of evidence coming to their attention when a disapproving Vermonter noted a paper coffee cup not in its proper recycling bin. The cup held the robber's holdup note and his DNA. And number two, a 46-year-old man was arrested in December after an evening at the Sands Casino in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and charged with leaving a server a non-monetary tip, that of a Valium pill. Well, needless to say, both of these guys will be chilling for quite some time to come. And a Florida woman has been charged after police say she hit an officer with a tampon. Local news outlets reported that 28-year-old Takora Fields was arrested and charged with aggravated battery on a law enforcement officer. A police report says Fields was involved in a fight with a St. Petersburg police officer after he responded. Police say Fields threatened to hit the officer with her tampon. Authorities say Fields then removed the feminine hygiene product and threw it at the officer, hitting him in the shoulder. Police say Fields tried to flee the scene, but the officer used a stun gun on her, and she was taken into custody. You know, there are so many potential punchlines to this story, and I do believe not a single one of them is politically correct, so let's just move on, shall we? Because finally, in this section of Stuff File News, we have a story to get to before we get to our next guest here on the program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You know, bike riders know the challenge of dressing warmly when pushing the pedals in sub-freezing temperatures. Now, one man in Austria didn't even try. He was naked. State broadcaster ORF says the biker, nude and drunk, was detained after a nighttime joyride that included trying to steer his cycle through the revolving door of a hotel, pulling a fire alarm, and then dropping his bike to sprint through part of the southern city of Velach with police in hot pursuit. Not much else was hot, by the way. ORF said that temperatures dipped to minus 13 degrees Celsius, that's about 8.5 degrees Fahrenheit, the night of the caper. Well, you know, I'll say what I always say when a nude cyclist story comes up, and apparently they do pop up quite frequently. I think the most dangerous part of cycling nude for guys is slippery pedals. Yeah, that'll set you free. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Last year, we talked to Lainey Morris, who runs Goat Yoga in Oregon. Well, that's not the only type of yoga you can find in that state. Since 2013, Mickey Trowbridge has been doing something called beer yoga. To find out what that's all about, Mickey joins us on the line, also from Oregon. Hi, Mickey.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So what is going on in Oregon?
All kinds of amazing things. We apparently like to get creative here.
First of all, do you know Lainey? Do you know each other?
We don't know each other, no. I've had a little bit of interaction with her and some of her teachers just online, but I don't know them personally.
Okay. So let's talk about beer yoga. How did this get started? I know it was back in 2013. And what is the whole premise? How does it work exactly?
Yeah. So it kind of happened as a fluke. My husband and I were out on Rogue Ale's hop farm and outside of Salem, Oregon. And it's a beautiful farm on a river, and my husband actually had the idea of somebody doing yoga out there just because it was a beautiful place. And we contacted Rogue, and they were all for it. And so we started our first class in the summer of 2013, and thought we'd have maybe 20 friends come out for yoga and then a beer afterwards. And we had 100 people show up for that first class, which we were not expecting and not prepared for in any way. And it was amazing. And what we discovered there is we weren't the only people that enjoyed both yoga and beer, and that it can be this really lovely blend of coming together for a yoga practice, which tends to be focused more on yourself and giving yourself what you need, and then not just heading back off and into life and into obligations after class, but staying and gathering as a community and sharing a beer. And so it just sort of fell into place. It wasn't a plan. It wasn't strategic. It just sort of organically came together. And so we made that a monthly class. And then as other breweries started to hear about it, other breweries wanted to be involved. And so it became a weekly thing, and it started to spread across the state for me into different cities and different breweries. And it's just been fun to watch the power of bringing people together around, we call it the combination of things that make you feel good, in moderation, of course, and having people share in a yoga practice and then share a pint, and the power that that has to form community and friendships.
Well, you said you expected only about 20 people initially, but you got 100. How did you first get the word out, first of all? How did you first get the word out when you were only expecting 20 and you ended up with 100? Were they regular yoga clients or were these new people to you or what?
A lot of them were new people, and then some were regular yoga clients. So we put it on Facebook. We put a flyer up in the studio, and Rogue put a flyer up in their tasting room there. Honestly, though, we kind of dropped the ball on marketing it, which was why we were so surprised. I had a really busy summer and actually lost my father that summer, and after we had scheduled it, and personally just didn't have the emotional capacity to really focus on marketing it. And so that's why we went out there, and I was like, you know what, we've not done a whole lot of work on marketing this. Let's just go have some fun with the people that show up. We knew that we had a group of friends coming to support. And so that was what we kind of went into it expecting. And then we got out there and the cars just didn't stop. And I still to this day really have no idea how people found out about it. It was a mix of regular yogis, people who just liked beer, people who'd never done yoga before, people who randomly heard about it from a friend of a friend. But to me, it was a sign that this is something that our community obviously is craving, is thirsty for, pun intended, and it's a great opportunity to bring people together. And that first class, I didn't even have a microphone or a speaker. I literally was in a field screaming, breathe and down dog and all the things that we were doing. We now have a mic and a speaker, so that's resolved. But I think it was just the universe or God or whatever you believe in, higher power wise, saying this is a thing that you should follow and continue.
You mentioned you and your husband went to the brewery, and your husband liked the locale, the tranquility of it all. Is it more the location than the product that first drew you to this? In other words, not the beer, it's just the outdoors and the location.
In that case, it was the outdoors, but in all of the other breweries, it's the location, and here's why. I mean, beer after class and beer itself is fantastic. I love beer personally, but it's not beer required. Like, you can come to these classes and you can follow it with kombucha or water or wine or cider. Whatever you want to follow your practice with. For me, I personally believe, other than the community aspect of gathering over a drink after class, the breweries themselves provide an atmosphere for practicing yoga that appeals to people that might be intimidated by a studio. And we hear this all the time, right? I never thought I could practice yoga. I never wanted to practice yoga. I never thought I would. But then I heard that I could go to a brewery that I hang out in all the time anyway and feels comfortable to me. And do yoga, and all of a sudden it feels approachable and like something that people want to do that never thought that they would. The breweries tend to be a little bit less assuming, a little bit more approachable. It's not a quiet, empty space that feels sort of like if you drop something or make a noise too loud, it's going to echo and be really obvious that you don't know what you're doing. It's a space with energy and people and noise and sounds, and a lot of people when they're new to yoga and meditation actually struggle to meditate or get quiet, really quiet.
The reason why I bring up that question is there seems to be the sort of like the Zen quality to it, because I asked that same question back when I talked to Lainey Morse. It wasn't the idea initially of the goats, it was the fact that you were outside on a farm and the goats were an added plus.
Yep. Yes. And I think that very first one, that Rogue Hop Farm, the outdoor beauty and tranquility of it was definitely a draw to that one. It's a beautiful space, and each of our breweries offers something a little bit different, whether it's We have breweries where we're in the tap room and they're still open for business. Well, we're doing yoga in the middle of the tap room, and so it's noisy and somewhat chaotic. We have breweries where we're in a beautiful loft that actually looks like a yoga studio, but the noise of the brewery is kind of distant and in the background. We have a brewery that is right next to an island, a tiny little island that looks out at the Bridge of the Gods here in Oregon, and it's gorgeous, and that's a draw there. So I think what's kind of fun about this is instead of having one studio space that you always go to, it's different every single time, and people can start to find the space that feels inviting to them, makes them want to show up to their mat and breathe and move and do something that's good for them in a space that feels inspiring, whether it's because of beauty or approachability or familiarity.
Now, I've not been a yoga enthusiast at all in my life, so I'm asking this next question based on something you said earlier, and that is that there, even though you have a class of people, there seems to be a singularity in that you're at one with either the teacher or yourself or both, but not necessarily the whole class. Mm-hmm. And now what you're doing seems to bring people more together because there's an activity that goes with it after. Am I correct in saying that?
Yep, definitely. I think so often in a studio setting, yes, you're moving together and you're breathing together, but it's pretty common that you come into class. It's expected, typically like a rule that you're supposed to be quiet in the studio. And so you come into class, you set up your mat, you do your practice, and then typically people leave right after class. And it's not uncommon to go to a yoga class for weeks or months and not actually meet anybody, especially if you're a little bit more of an introvert. And this changes that. And it's not just yoga and beer that changes that. There's lots of different blends of yoga or settings of yoga that encourage that social aspect. But for us, that community, that connection is just as important as the yoga in terms of what we're trying to do here. The world, especially right now, needs people coming together more, and that's a goal of what we do.
Besides the yoga enthusiasts after class, you know, imbibing in a beer or two, and the cost that mm-hmm. entails, does the yoga class cost any more than a typical yoga class?
Nope. So we have set the pricing for our yoga classes to be just slightly cheaper than a drop-in in the area. And that's part of our mission, that approachability and accessibility to yoga. So removing all of the potential barriers to yoga. So in the brewery, removing that barrier of feeling intimidated, but cost-wise, trying to remove the financial barrier as well. So half of our classes are free. They're donation-based. The beer obviously is not free, but the yoga is. And so we have a growler that we put out at the beginning of class and the end of class that people can put cash into or other ways to leave appreciation and thanks. So if you can't afford a yoga class, this is an opportunity for you to come and get some yoga. And then the other classes that we have that we charge for, we've set them to be just a tiny bit cheaper than the drop-in rate in the area, the city that class is in, and then plus the cost of a pint. And so registration includes yoga class and a pint.
Okay. And since you've been doing this, again, since 2013, I asked the same question of Lainey, what kind of media mm-hmm. response are you getting, not just in your state, but beyond? I mean, here you are talking to somebody in Canada. What kind of attention have you received for doing beer yoga?
The attention comes and goes. It definitely goes in waves. Like right now, there's been a lot because of the article that ran and Mashable. But definitely it's a novel thing, or at least people think it's novel. For us, there's a lot of intention behind what we're doing. And so it definitely gets media attention from time to time over the years. And so it's just fun to share what we're doing with people. I actually coordinate with a girl out of Ohio. Her name's Melissa. She runs a brand called Balance and Brews. And her and I do national road trips during the summer where we take yoga and beer on the road and go city to city and teach in different breweries. And so that also gets a lot of national and international attention when we do that, just because it's not the typical average yoga offering. It's something different, and so people pick it up and like to share the hoppy goodness, we call it.
Well, kudos to you for coming up with something new and different. People can find out more information by going to your website. I believe it's mikkiyoga.com, MIKKIyoga.com.
Yeah, actually, the yoga and beer site is cheersandnamaste.com.
Cheersandnamaste.com. So, okay.
So yep, cheersandnamaste.com.
Cheersandnamaste.com. Mickey, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. Continued success with all you do.
Thank you. Same to you.
Mickey Trowbridge from Beer Yoga in Oregon. Again, their website is cheersandnamaste.com. You can also visit my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0389, and you'll find links to Mickey's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Imagine playing a board game like Monopoly if the rules changed every time it was your turn to make a move. That's what some people say it's like trying to comply with federal regulations. A home builder told Congress last year that it's been trying to get a federal permit to develop a piece of property for nearly 30 years. The builder says that throughout every step of the process, the rules have changed and new requirements have been added. But what makes the delay so frustrating is that the relevant federal law hasn't changed since 1972. It was the way that bureaucrats kept reinterpreting the law that was the problem. Let's be fair, protecting our environment is important. Government regulation is needed, but the long, drawn-out process of enforcing those regulations can be even worse than having bad regulations in the first place. While the new administration in Washington considers how to eliminate unneeded regulations, one of the first priorities should be speeding up enforcement of regulations already on the books. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And Stuart Nolman has all the news in books when it comes to news in books. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Peter. I could say welcome to the Nolman File, but I don't feel like going on Fox News, to be honest with you.
Okay.
But speaking of files and Fox News and this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at the best-selling novel, memoir by Megyn Kelly. Because if you remember about a year and a half ago, August 6, 2015, Day of the Fateful Republican Presidential Candidates Debate in Cleveland, in which Megyn Kelly, her question to Donald Trump about his treatment of women would make her a household name. But there was one major preoccupation. The former Fox News host and future NBC News host would have before the debate even started, and that was thanks to a sudden case of a stomach virus she contracted just hours before the live debate went on the air, which made her quite violently ill and almost put her out of commission. They even put a wastebasket at her feet, because in the event that she had to upchuck in the middle of the debate, she was ready, and they were ready to cut her mic off and turn the camera away from her. But yet, through the illness and controversial question to Trump, Kelly survived the stormy night in Cleveland, not to mention the other storms that would come her way as a result of the question. And when it comes to survival, both personal and professional, Megyn Kelly is someone who knows how to weather them. Now, in her book, which is called Settle for More, which has been a bestseller, she doesn't try to elicit a feeling of pity from the reader. She recounts how she managed to work her way up the ladder to a great degree of success in two mostly male-dominated career fields, law and news media, through a great deal of struggle and hard work, yet at the same time deflecting the many slings and arrows that were thrown at her. And there are plenty of stories offered in the book that give the reader an unblemished portrait of how Megyn Kelly became the multifaceted individual that has drawn so many millions of viewers every night to watch The Kelly File on Fox, and probably more when she goes to NBC News later this year. Now, perhaps the most compelling part of the book, and is a vivid example of Kelly's strength and resilience in times of adversity, is the portion towards the end of the book that chronicles her battles with now President Donald Trump before and during his run for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. It begins early in 2015, before he announced his run, which he launched a campaign to charm and court Kelly with constant phone calls, personal notes, highly complimentary tweets, and even an offer to pick up the tab when she spent the weekend with some old friends at the Trump Soho Hotel in New York City. And then she finds the motivation behind this campaign, so to speak, in which when one of her early interviews with him, just before he announced his candidacy, he tried to convince her to ask him about some of the less than reliable polls that were favorable to him instead of the series of reputable polls that stated he was trailing behind some other Republican candidates, which he flatly refused to do. But, you know, you have to give a great deal of respect to Megyn Kelly for her courage and how she handled the swift firestorm that greeted her after the debate. Her strong will, courage, and determination in the face of these attacks, which could have easily toppled any individual, both physically and emotionally, is a true testament to the inner strength she has built for herself through all the difficulties she faced throughout her life. As a result, somewhat reconciliation was established between the two, which also ended up with an interview with him on a year-end TV special Kelly was hosting that was dubbed the Trump Tower Accords.
Yes. Yep.
So whether you agree or not with Megyn Kelly's viewpoints or her tough, sometimes confrontational interview style, which ratchets up several notches if the interviewee doesn't get their facts straight, her book, Settle for More, will inform you, enlighten you, and most importantly, inspire you. She is someone who started with less, and by settling for more, she boldly faced many struggles and obstacles, and as a result, achieved many of her goals, both professionally and personally.
Now, I'm guessing, I'm just going on a limb here, that there isn't a foreword in the book written by Bill O'Reilly.
No.
Okay.
No forwards, special forwards, prefaces, no.
Is there actually any mention of Bill in the book?
Yes, you know, she devotes quite a bit of time to her time at Fox News, and she does mention Bill O'Reilly, and she has some pretty kind words about him, and he was pretty supportive of her, because basically, you know, those two shows were, you know, didn't have the same kind of slant. Actually, she's pretty kind to O'Reilly.
Mm. So the book is entitled
Settle for More by Megyn Kelly. It's published by Harper, and it's $36.99.
And while we're in that genre, what other books do you recommend, sir?
Well, I figured, you know, memoirs by two women journalists. The first one that I recommend is Audition by Barbara Walters, which was her massive autobiography, which basically is a very thorough look at her life and career, you know, how she set the bar, how she set the standard for other female journalists that followed her in the 1970s and 80s. Great behind-the-scenes stuff of, you know, working on The View, working with Harry Reisner, working on The Today Show back in the 60s when, you know, basically she started off as you know, not as a Today Show girl, but, you know, being a female correspondent back then was sort of like a novelty. A terrific book, actually. And also one I think you've read, And So It Goes by Linda Ellerbee.
Oh, one of my favorite books of all time.
Yeah, I read it when it came out in paperback in 1987. And
so did I, yeah.
That if Barbara Walters' book set the bar, you know, talk about her life and career, how she set the standard, Linda Ellerbee's book, which talks about her career in journalism, you know, working on NBC News when he had a late night show and doing NBC News updates, that's set the standard for not just female journalist memoirs, but journalist memoirs as a whole.
Wow. I was working on a travel program, and I was traveling through a lot of the Caribbean, so I was binge reading several books while I was on those trips, and they were all media-related books. I read Linda Ellerbee's during that trip, Sam Donaldson's Hold On, Mr. President, and also the Dan Rather's book, plus Ed Joyce's book. I read all four of those in the span of a month while I was traveling. I was on copious amounts of flights, so a lot of reading. And Linda Ellerbee is by far one of my favorite books of all time. That's a great book.
Yes, it is. And Dan Rather, The Camera Never Blinks. I think it's the one you're talking about,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Just making sure, because he's written several other books, but that one is the better one.
Yes. I have some choice ideas on Dan Rather's Hold Mind, especially if you read Ed Joyce's book first and then you read Dan Rather's book. It's like, well, that's interesting. And that's all I'm going to say. Anyway, this week's book is...
It's called Settle for More by Megyn Kelly, published by Harper, and it's $36.99.
And how can people find you, sir?
Well, you won't find me on Fox News, that's for sure, but you can find me every week in the Montreal Times in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
And you're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Norman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about in the home stretch for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and I've got a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But first, just a moment for a word about Elita Hair Products of Beverly Hills. You know, many hair products contain harmful ingredients that can damage your hair and scalp. Well, at Elita Hair, their policy is to use only great natural ingredients without harmful chemicals. All Elita Hair products are made in the U.S. and are not, I repeat, not tested on animals. They're safe, healthy, natural, and luxurious, but not at the usually high salon prices. Now, listeners to the Stuff File program, you have a special offer. Visit Elita Hair and their website at elitahair.com. That's E-L-I-T-A hair.com. And when you purchase Elita Hair products, use the promo code STUFF10, and that'll get you a 10% discount. That promo code again is STUFF10. That's STUPH10. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the advertisers page, and you'll find the promo code and the link on that page. And the promo code again is STUFF10. Their website is elitahair.com. Your hair will love it. Okay, back to the Stuff File news. A West Virginia man has admitted to leaving a casino to rob a bank before returning to continue gambling. 52-year-old Carrie Johnson of Charleston pleaded guilty to a robbery charge. Johnson had been at Mardi Gras Casino in Nitro for hours on August the 2nd when he put down a $25 chip to hold his spot. Prosecutors say Johnson then drove 13 miles to a Charleston bank and gave tellers a note saying he had a bomb and a weapon, and then he robbed it. Johnson then returned to the blackjack table and kept gambling. Johnson told a judge he'd taken quite a few drugs that day, but recognized himself after seeing video from the bank. He faces 5 to 18 years in prison when he will be sentenced in March. Well, I don't know if he has a drug problem, but this story certainly proves to me that he has a gambling problem. Yeah. And a 23-year-old man pleaded not guilty Wednesday to an abuse of public records charge after police say he faxed a fake court memo to jail staff in an attempt to release his friend. Justin A. Colbert became a target of the Lincoln, Nebraska police investigation after Lancaster County jail staff reportedly received a suspicious fax on July 23rd. The fax purported to be from Lancaster County court staff saying a bond payment of $25,000 had been made for an inmate there detained in a weapons case and that he should be released, according to police, but the courts were closed that day, as it was a Saturday, and the fax had been sent through a web service with an attached email and phone number that didn't belong to county court. Investigators narrowed in on Colbert after learning the computer the fax was sent from belonged to one of his residents, and Colbert had served jail time with the inmate named in the fax. The email address used in the fax belonged to Colbert, police said. The offense is a misdemeanor punishable by up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. Colbert is already in jail serving a sentence related to a theft case. Well, clearly, not a bright boy. And I was tempted to make this moron the idiot of the day, but I didn't. Perhaps in a different week he might have made it, but not this time around. However, this next story, boys and girls, well, this is the moment you've all been waiting for, because it is indeed time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
56-year-old Alvin Neal robbed a bank in San Diego, California. According to a plea agreement, Neal approached a window and told the teller, "You're being robbed. Don't make a mistake." He got away with $565. The teller, however, was able to provide police with his identity. Before speaking to the teller, Neil had swiped his ATM card through the reader at the window in front of the teller, and from that information, investigators got his name and address, and they tracked him down. Neil admitted to the robbery and was sentenced to 3 years, 10 months in prison, and ordered to pay $565 in restitution. You know, I'm sure he thinks he'll pay it back as soon as he has access to an ATM. Because why? Oh, why? If he was planning to rob a bank, would he swipe his ATM card right in front of the teller that he's about to rob? Well, one reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0389. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0389. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.